Today, we're going to be answering the fundamental question, are your stocks and bonds safe? Do you even hold them? And if you do, why did they bother to install a trigger if they never intended to use it? Hello, everyone. I am Dr. Chris Martinson of Peak Prosperity. We are continuing in our Great Taking series. This is going to be episode 5. We're going to now talk about the case precedents, and we want to answer this one question. What would happen to my stocks and bonds if, or should we say when, a financial storm erupts? We know there's going to be another financial storm. The question is, how will the system behave during that storm? We're going to answer a little bit of that today. The territory we've covered so far, you know, I read The Great Taking, the book by David Rogers Webb, and I wanted to answer for myself and go deeper, how true is this? And we're going to deliver our verdict on that at the end of this. But I went down and I read through all of these various codes here, titles in this case, the Uniform Commercial Code, those two articles down there. But today, we're going to be talking about case precedents because, well, if they make the laws, that's one thing. But if you've tested the laws and they've been run up, say, all the way from the district courts on up through the appellate courts to the Supreme Court, well, now it's a thing. Is it a thing? Well, let's start here. What is the importance of a case precedent? Just to make sure we're all on the same page from ChatGPT. Very helpful. I like how it frames things sometimes. This is one of those times. It says here, in legal terms, a case precedent, also known as a legal precedent or a judicial precedent, refers to a legal decision or judgment that serves as an authoritative guide or rule in subsequent similar cases. So you have a case precedent. Future judges don't have to think about it or litigate it. They can go, oh, that already got decided. We're just going to follow that, right? And one of the many benefits from case precedents is you get stability and predictability. Case precedents, they provide stability and predictability to the legal system by establishing clear rules and principles that govern similar cases. So now we're going to be talking about the fact that cases have been established, precedent has been set for how the taking of assets can happen. So we're going to look at a few of those cases today. As well, fairness and equality. Precedents promote fairness and equality by ensuring that similar cases are treated similarly because the justice system is supposed to be fair. Hey, look, we took your stuff from you. Fair and square. Case precedent. All right, so let's keep going down this path. Remember, we talked about this in the prior sections. There's this thing called 546E of Title 11, which is the bankruptcy code. I'm going to tell you how that came about. And it's really, so I know you're like, oh no, legal stuff. It's really important. It matters a lot. And 546E talks about the limitations on avoiding power. So a trustee of a bankrupt entity, potentially your broker, or a clearinghouse you didn't even know held some of your assets, or an intermediary, or whatever. If the trustee overseeing that failed entity wants to seize everything, freeze it all, put a stay on everything, as they say, well, 546E steps in and says, well, notwithstanding all these other sections of the bankruptcy code, section 544, which is important, 545, 547, 548, A1B, or 548B, notwithstanding, just set all those aside. Those are irrelevant. As of this this law going into play, the trustee may not avoid a transfer, that is a margin payment, as defined in these other sections and all of this, and we've talked about this before, because these are all financial intermediaries, financial players, commodity brokers, forward contract merchants, stock brokers, financial institutions, something called a financial participant, kind of vague, on purpose, and all of this overly complicated, but basically says, look, if your entity that you have your stocks and bonds with, or a derivative of that that you didn't even know about, goes into bankruptcy, the trustee overseeing all that, you can't get access to your funds, but these people can, who have this 546E, what's called the safe harbor protection. So what does that mean? Well, first, have case precedents been set? Yes, here's a bunch of case precedents that I looked at. We're going to be looking at that last one down there, Lehman versus JP Morgan. That's an important one because it really lays bare exactly what we're up against. And remember, your claims, they're typically just, you have what's called a security entitlement. You don't actually have anything like a senior claim. In fact, a security entitlement is kind of an unsecured claim against your own stuff held in trust or in fiduciary manner for you by some other party, right? A stockbroker, clearinghouse, whatever. All right. And it says, you know, that, well, who is the senior contract? Who is the senior claim? Well, these are things called qualified financial contracts, QFCs. Qualified financial contracts is a very big designation, includes all kinds of things. Basically anything you can think of plus derivatives. And we've covered that in prior episodes. So the importance of a case precedent, back to ChatGPT for a second, incremental development of law, they say, well, you know, precedents contribute to the gradual development of the law over time. The bankruptcy code has been developed carefully over time. If people have squabbled over assets for millennia. And then of late, it's really in the last 15, 20 years, Congress, in its infinite wisdom, has decided, let's just rewrite whole chunks of this. And they can't know what the impact of that's going to be. I'm going to show you what the impact has already been and what is likely to be in the future. As well, they say here, as news cases are decided and precedents are established, legal principles evolve and adapt to changing societal norms, technological advancements, and emerging issues. So principles are going to evolve. Okay, I get that. But remember, derivatives are a fairly recent evolution in things, and they are qualified financial contracts. And by the way, a QFC refers to any, that's why it's in pink, any securities contract, commodity contract, forward contract, repo, repurchase agreement, swap agreement, or any similar agreement that the FDIC, that's the corporation, determines by regulation, resolution, or order to be a QFC for purposes of this paragraph. So it's like, listen, anything that these big boys and girls come up with, all the big banks and everybody, hedge funds, private equity, whatever those people come up with, probably a QFC. Your stocks and bonds, even though you bought them with after-tax money, took risk, held them, they're not qualified financial contracts. They are security entitlements. So before we go further, just a quick understanding of how the federal court system is arranged, because, you know, maybe you've heard these terms and didn't quite know where they fit. But let me see. Oh, wrong one. Let's come over here. Let me get my laser pointer out. So over here, you have your U.S. tax court. So if somebody comes into bankruptcy or one of your these firms we're talking about gets in trouble, they might start here at a bankruptcy court. And or depending on the type of claim, it may be over here in a district court. It gets litigated and plaintiff or defendant doesn't like the outcome and it gets appealed and it goes up to one of the 12 districts courts of appeal. So there's 12 circuits out there. So it goes up into the appeals court. And if defendant or plaintiff doesn't like the outcome of that, it can end up in the Supreme Court to be legislated there. By the way, this 546E safe harbor provision has gone all the way up to here and it's been upheld pretty strongly. So this is a law firm, Davis Polk. They had a client memorandum that I found and they talked about this case of Merit Management Group LP versus FTI Consulting. There's the docket number. Resolves the Supreme Court finally interpreted this whole thing in the Merit case. That's what it's called, the Merit case. And so it resolved a circuit court split, holds that the bankruptcy code section 546E safe harbor protects only transfer to, by to, or for the benefit of protected entities. If you're wondering, am I a protected entity? Spoiler alert, no. They say here in an opinion dated February 27, 2018, the Supreme Court unanimously affirmed a Seventh Circuit decision, that's this appeals, that held that Section 546E Safe Harbor protects transfers from avoidance, meaning, hey, we transferred all this money out of this failing institution and these other people have it now. You can't avoid that. You can't claw that back. The trustee can't come in and say, that doesn't look right. Let me take that back. Says it protects transfers from avoidance only if the transfer sought to be avoided is a transfer by, to, or for the benefit of a protected entity. That's an entity enumerated in 546E. For example, a financial institution as defined there, et cetera. So you're starting to get a sense here that like, oh, wait a minute. Certain people are protected, certain entities, and I'm not one of them. that's absolutely the case. So they talked about this and they said, well, you know, this 546E of the bankruptcy code provides a safe harbor, protects certain transfers from avoidance, right? The only kind of transfer that can be taken back is if you can prove it was actual intentional fraud. There's cases of fraud that aren't quite as clear cut. Those would be some constructive fraud, they call it, where it's kind of like, did you know that thing was about to go bust and then you transferred $1 billion out the day before? That looks constructively fraudulent, right? So they said, yeah, except for that, except for actual fraud, actual legit fraud. Like I sold a toaster oven for $1 billion. That was the transfer, right? And they're like, oh no, that's fraudulent. They say here, quote, to qualify for Section 546E safe harbor, a transfer must meet two requirements. One that turns upon the category of transfer, and a second that turns on the parties to the transfer. First, the transfer sought to be avoided must be a margin payment, a settlement payment, or a transfer in connection with a securities contract or one of these derivatives, right? Second, transfer must be made by, to, or for the benefit of a protected entity. And they've listed them out. And guess what? It's banks and financial firms and things like that, including something now called a financial participant, which is a little vague. Now, in getting ready for this, I read all of these things. I read all these cases, so you don't have to, right? And there's a lot of big cases in there. But if you were going to read only one article on this whole thing, you really wanted to understand it, you could do no better anywhere than to do with Charles Mooney Jr.'s piece here in the University of Pennsylvania Law School. Came across this. It's a 2014 article about the bankruptcy codes, safe harbors for settlement payments and securities contracts. When is safe? Too safe? Awesome review article. We're going to step through this. And when we do, trust me, it's worth it, because what you'll come away with is this understanding of how this sausage got made. This legal stuff, everything I found out so far, you know, you're thinking, well, this great taking, it sounds evil. It sounds like some people sat down in a smoke-filled room with cigars and they came up with this thing. I'm going to show you now that this developed over time, that it started out probably with decent intentions, really small, and it's mushroomed into this grotesque thing that we face today. And that has all of the risk contained within it. Once you understand how this developed in such a way that I guarantee you, there is nobody in Congress who understands this. In fact, nobody really knows how this is going to play out. I've read enough of these cases. They're complicated. They're nuanced. Sometimes they win in the court because they made a better argument than the other side. And it's all very less black and white than you maybe would hope, because we're talking about, do I own my assets or not? Should be clear. It's not that clear. So let's take a step through this together. Charles Mooney's article. Thank you, Charles, for writing this. Mr. Mooney did a service for me anyway. First, in his introduction, he said, you know, this article addresses insolvency, law-related issues in connection with certain financial market contracts. These include securities contracts, commodity contracts, forward contracts, repos, swaps, other derivatives, and these master netting agreements. We'll talk about that in a second. The rights of a party to one of these contracts when its counterparty enters an insolvency proceeding is an important consideration for regulators of the markets. Okay? In the United States, the bankruptcy code provides special treatment, safe harbors for these contracts collectively. QFCs, qualified financial contracts. This special treatment is considerably more favorable for non-debtor parties to QFCs than the rules applicable to non-debtor parties to other contracts with the debtor. So, bankruptcy term, the debtor is the thing that went bankrupt. That's what they call them, the debtor. So there are non-debtor parties who actually have claims, right? They might have contracts with the debtor. So we would call these creditors, right? So it might be everything from the parties who are, cleaning the offices to providing other services, that they have certain claims. Well, those would be non-debtor parties with other contracts. They don't, you know, who has preference? It's going to be these non-debtor parties who have the qualified financial contract. So non-debtor parties is just a way of saying not the place that just went bankrupt, but the people who hold a contract, a QFC with them, they have very special status. It's been super enshrined. They say here, quote, yet even some strong critics of the safe harbors concede that some special treatment may be warranted. I get that, right? Even while maintaining that the package of benefits provided by the current law is excessively protective of the big banks, of the masters of the universe, of all these big firms out there, right? Of course, they have better lobbyists than you and I do. And we know that Congress and the Senate have no interest in protecting you or I. They gave that up a long time ago. They play a very different game now. And what they do is they respond to these lobbyists. By the way, you're going to see some of this language in some of these laws. There's not a chance in the world Congress wrote even one lick of this stuff. It is too legal dense, too white shoe, amazing, sophisticated, every word just nuanced. There's not a chance in the world Congress wrote any of those. These are all laws that got slipped into somebody's pocket, who went into the Banking and Finance Committee, slipped it into a piece of writing that was going to come out, and now it's part of our law system. And it just developed, and here we are. And you know what? I agree. Maybe you should consider some things should have some special treatment within the system. You might imagine, like if you went to your bank and said, I want to get a mortgage loan. And they said, great, we're going to lock in a rate. Later on, if they didn't like that, they said, you know what? We're not going to give you that locked rate. We're just going to make it some other rate, right? That would be a foul. They're just saying there's certain types of contracts that when they get written, it's a foul, whether or not it's inconvenient for the entity that wrote it. I get that. There are certain contracts that really ought to be honored, but not to this extent. You're going to see they've protected everything. This safe harbor is a big old fat welcoming harbor for them. All right. The original reason way back when, I love what Charles Mooney does here. He goes through and helps us understand where this came from. So let's start with this legislative history. It's actually more fascinating than I thought. The bankruptcy code safe harbors began modestly, he writes, in 1978. A little toe in the water. Section 362B6 of the original 1978 code exempted from the automatic stay set off. I'll tell you what that means in a second, with respect to various sorts of commodity related contracts. So a set off is, hey, I've got a contract with you and, you know, it's going up or down and maybe we have other contracts. The set off is, hey, you know what, if I held these contracts with you and some were up and some were down, we would net those and say, hey, let's just walk from this whole thing because you're going into bankruptcy. And the automatic stay is that when you enter bankruptcy, if you did this personally, there would be an automatic stay that prevents your creditors from coming after you. It's an automatic stop. Creditors, go home, wait for us to contact you via the trustee. So in 1978, they exempted that automatic stay set off, meaning, okay, you enter into a bankruptcy, and next thing you know, certain commodity-related contracts, the trustee can't do anything. There are these other parties on the other end of these QFCs for these commodity contracts were able to come in and continue the deal and accelerate it, terminate it, whatever they needed to do to make it go away so they no longer had that contract, right? So that's what started in 1978. It was just certain commodity-related contracts. Who even knows what it was in relation to? Might have been some corn futures or pork bellies. We don't know, right? I'm sure somebody does. But that was just where it started. And of course, this is the rule of government. Once the nose of the camel gets under the tent, next thing you know, you have a camel in your tent. And carrying on in yellows with respect to section, this other section, the Senate report about this whole shenanigans here, without citing this section specifically, noted that one of the main objectives of the commodity broker liquidation subchapter, which is that automatic stay thing we talked about there, was in part, quote, is the protection of commodity market stability. So this is the first time we're seeing this concept of, oh, we have to do these things for market stability. What is market stability? You know, we have a Financial Stability Council now. And nobody can answer for me, what does that mean? What threshold is there? What criteria do you use to say, if this bankruptcy proceeds using standard chapter and verse, what happens? The markets become unstable. What does that mean, right? In truth, it really ought to happen sometimes that you have these market clearing events and bad companies go out of business. That would be a very creative destruction, Joseph Schumpeter, awesome thing that should happen. That should happen. Bad companies should go out of business. It should happen. But at any rate, they said, yeah, you know, this is the first time in 1978, they're like, God, we need commodity market stability. And well, once you know it, next thing you know, this be provided a justification for expanding the scope of a number of other safe harbor provisions. It was such a good idea. with commodity market stability. On it went. So 1982, 4 years later, we now have amendments to this. Charles is writing, they are intended in part to rectify the conspicuous omission in the 1978 Code of Special Treatment for Securities Contract. In view of the special treatment for commodity contracts, hey, securities people are like, Wall Street's like, but you gave special treatment to these commodity contracts. What an oversight. You need to rectify this right away. We need our contracts covered too. So they did. And Congress applied the same 1978 commodity rationale. Like, oh, we have case precedent. We already have this market stability thing. We better do this for these other things here. And so they started expanding it and they brought in more securities contracts. Why does this matter to you? Because we're talking about your stocks and bonds now. Okay. And they said here, Congress said, quote, several of the amendments are intended to minimize the displacement caused in the commodities and securities markets in the event of a major bankruptcy affecting those industries. Minimize the displacement. What even does that mean? What displacement? People lost money because they made bad bets? Sure. Yeah, that ought to happen. It's not a bad thing. Quote, carrying on, while Congress did not use the term systemic risks, that was its concern, saying, quote, certain protections are necessary to prevent the insolvency of one commodity or security firm from spreading to other firms and possibly threatening the collapse of the affected market. So that was their concern, like, oh gosh, you know, these contracts are getting so big, so powerful, so overwhelming that we're a little worried that if a fire catches, this whole forest will burn. Crown fire, terrible. So I know what you're thinking, because you're a normal, average, rational, brilliant person, which is, wouldn't you want fewer of those things that could burn the markets down, not more rules protecting them in case they catch fire? You're absolutely right. That would be the correct way to go, but that's not how they went. That was 1982, and this probably is sounding familiar because, and this, I love that photo that the New York Times put of Timothy Geithner, because it does look like a mugshot, and he deserves one. Because remember, he was the architect of bringing forward into the lexicon of the United States, at least, this concept of too big to fail. And in 2014, well after the great financial crisis, allegedly we've recovered from that whole thing, he writes here, of course, big banks are still too big to fail. He wrote here, U.S. big banks remain too big to fail without bringing down the financial system, according to former Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner, who said that the efforts to prevent banks from receiving future bailouts are like Moby Dick for economists or regulators. It's not just quixotic. It's misguided. Yeah, so misguided to think about how could we prevent banks from getting future bailouts? And he's like, that's just dumb. But of course, he came from the belly of the beast. He grew up on a very immoral Wall Street firm, went to the Treasury Department, affected a bunch of immoral stuff, and then went back to that ecosystem of swampiness. So no surprise there, but the big surprise is, wow, we almost had a lights out great financial crisis in 08, 09 due to these crazy contracts that had somehow mushroomed into, you know, these massive, massive things. And we had too big to fail banks. And he's like, oh, you're just going to have to get used to the fact there's such a thing as too big to fail. Of course, you're going to have to bail them out next time they get in trouble. Join me on camera 3 for a second. This is just stupid. Okay, come on. All right, back to camera 1. Okay, let's carry on. Now, how did all that deconcentration work out? Of course, no, it didn't. You can see now that we used to have 14,000-ish banks out there. And then by 2022, there were only 4,000 banks. And by 2042, it's going to get cut in half again, and then cut in half or a third again. So the whole idea here is that we're getting more and more larger banks, or fewer and fewer smaller banks. And that concentrates the risk, which guarantees that Geithner's right. You would be stupid to say, wow, too big to fail creates giant, massive risks that could burn the whole financial system down. So let's have more of them. It's just broken. All right. But then 42 years ago, 1982, we finally got 546E. And it was born, and constructive fraud was removed. Because that was such an impediment, that whole idea that you could accuse people of constructive fraud or protective or preferential transfer. which means you've transferred something preferentially. Like, I transferred all the money out of my failing firm to my mother, right? And you would go, you can't do that. That's a preferential transfer. Anyway, the 1982 amendments, Charles Mooney continues writing here, says also added sections 546E and then D and then 555, all of that, which expanded the language to cover securities contracts as a result, except in cases of intentional fraudulent transfer. The trustee could not avoid or prevent margin or settlement payments made by or to a commodity broker, forward contract broker, stockbroker, or security clearing agency. That was then. They've included things they call financial institutions and financial participants. They've added more to that, right? Ordinarily, they say here, the use of such clauses would be rendered ineffective. And so these are the ipso facto clauses, which basically say that that's in fact. So that you could put a contract clause in there in your derivative contract. Remember, it's just a piece of paper. It's an agreement. In there, you could put something in that says, oh yeah, in the event of your bankruptcy, I need all my money back plus a kicker or whatever. You could put a clause in there that no longer could be like you can't write a contract in that preferentially favors yourself until this, they passed this. Great lobbyists, whoever these lobbyists were, they earned their money. Okay. And then you can hear this just creeping along as it slowly the 82 becomes 1984 and Congress, quote, added financial institution to the list of protected counterparties in 546E and 555. And the code then defined financial institution as a person. I love how they, a person, it's, they mean company, but they call it a person that is a commercial or savings bank, industrial savings bank, savings and loan association, or trust company, when any such person is acting as an agent or custodian for a customer in connection with a securities contract. So you can feel this creeping along. Now let's talk about these awesome, awesome lobbyists here. This is amazing. The next major revisions came in 1990, right? We haven't even gotten to like long-term capital management or any of that stuff. I mean, we're back in 1990, right? And they say these revisions were meant to bring the treatment of swaps under the bankruptcy code in line with the code's treatment of securities contracts. The main users of swaps, financial institutions, had three central concerns. These swaps, these are big derivatives. They're like, we have three concerns. The possibility of a bankruptcy trustee assuming favorable swap transactions and rejecting unfavorable ones. So we don't want a trustee picking and choosing, right? Good ones. Loss from market exposure if a swap contract could not be terminated immediately. So it's like, oh no, I'm doing business with a failed bankrupt institution. I might experience some losses. Oh no, that would be inappropriate for the protected class of Wall Street. That's what they're saying here. And so they say, if these concerns were not addressed, the International Swap Dealers Association, ISDA, contended, the potential exposure for all swap counterparties would be materially increased. And this could undermine the basic foundation of the swap market, which at that time had a notional value of near $2 trillion. I would like to tell you that now it has a notional value of $414 trillion. So mission accomplished. But look at that in pink down there. Quote, all three of ISDA's concerns were addressed by Congress. Oh, that's terrible. You know, that it might cause you to have to put more margin up, or you'd have to look at your counterparties more carefully, or gosh, if you have a failed contract with a failed institution, you might lose some money. Congress rode to the rescue. You want to find relationship goals, people. You want to find somebody who loves you as much as Congress loves bankers and the whole financial system. Carrying on, the BAPCPA, BAPCA, 2005. This was another big year in the evolution of this thing, which is now perched before you as the great taking. Quote, major changes would not come again until 2005 with the passage of the Bankruptcy Abuse Prevention and Consumer Protection Act. DC speak, you already know that the consumer's getting very unprotected, no lube. Kind of a thing. That's like when they say your Consumer Protection Act, you're like, oh no, it's going to hurt, isn't it? Yes, always does. Healthy Forest Act, right? Though focused on consumer and small business bankruptcy, BAPCA, contained a number of significant changes to the safe harbors. Changes that once again were declared to be designed to thwart systemic risk. And these amendments were a response to the near failure in 1998 of the hedge fund long-term capital management, which did some stupid things, made some bets they shouldn't have. They had the smartest guys in the room, allegedly, including a Nobel Prize winner for the Black-Scholes model. And still, guess what? They lost money. It happens. It's Wall Street. Big risk, big returns. Sometimes the risks go pear-shaped on you. You lose money. I don't know. Unacceptable to these people who are in this game because they want to always live in a world where it's heads they win, tails the taxpayers lose. Look, we bet big. It's great. It's amazing. We drive Ferraris. We're on TV. People love listening to us. We get invited back and we talk about what amazing people we are because we're geniuses. Uh-oh, calamity. We're going to need a bailout. And they, yeah, that's the game, folks. Only this time, there's not enough collateral in the system to satisfy all of those bets unless they have access to your collateral. And that's the story. So carrying on, the president's working group in 2005, PWG, it started invoking this concept of financial stability. So again, still with Charles Mooney here writing, in the wake of long-term capital management's near collapse, the president's working group on financial markets, PWG, which consisted of members of the Department of Treasury, Board of Governors of the Fed, the SEC, the CFTC, issued a report exploring the causes of LTCM's failure and recommending policy changes based on their findings. The PWG specifically recommended expanding and clarifying the definitions of the financial contracts eligible for netting and offsetting and allowing eligible counterparties to net across different kinds of contracts. Wouldn't that be better? In order to reduce the likelihood that the procedure for resolving a single insolvency will trigger other insolvencies due to the creditor's inability to control their market risk. That is a mouthful. What they're basically saying is, look, we want the right to pull up to a blackjack table, and we want the right to be able to bet as much as we want. And we also want the right to only collect chips when we win, but when we lose, we're going to need those chips of all the other players at the table. But out of professional courtesy, we won't take them from each other. We're going to need those to come from unsecured creditors because, yeah, they played the game. We told them about the risk. And they did sign fat documents saying, I agree to these things. We told them, and then it happened to them. Their fault, right? It's really, really immoral. And then magically, mortgage repos were added into this thing. So right there, it says significantly, the definition of a repurchase agreement was expanded under this was expanded to include repos on mortgage-related securities and mortgage loans. This is 2005. Think of the foresight involved for the people who are writing these things to go, right before the great financial crisis, to go, we probably should add mortgage-backed security repos and repurchase agreements to these qualified financial contracts. Good idea? Just think of the odds. They're really good at what they do. And then they added these things called master netting agreements, and say Congress addressed the issue. Yeah, Congress didn't address nothing. You had some lobbyists write this, and Congress was all hungover and passed it or something like that. And so Congress addressed the issue of cross-product netting by defining a new type of agreement, a master netting agreement. And an M&A is an agreement that can provide for the exercise of netting, set off, liquidation, termination, acceleration, or closeout, right? With respect to securities contracts, derivatives, all these derivatives. Consequently, can provide for netting among and all the financial instruments that might arise between counterparties. So you could say, listen, I got a lot of stuff going on with these, you know, with this other firm out there. I got swaps, I got repos, I got, you know, forward contracts, I got all kinds of stuff. You know what? We'll just sign up an M&A that says, listen, if you get in trouble, we're just going to just make sure I get my money, okay? Across all these things. So it's just like a grab bag catch-all. That way you don't have to like make sure each contract is carefully written, all that stuff. And then we carrying on, we continue to creep forward. The BEPCPA also defined a new type of counterparty, which is a financial participant. Is anybody an entity with at least $1 billion in notional or principal amount outstanding or $100 million in mark-to-market securities contracts? And again, by doing so, Congress sought to reduce systemic risk by allowing entities that meet the financial participant dollar requirements but would not otherwise qualify as a protected counterparty. Like, wonder who this could be. Congress also sought to reduce systemic risk by including clearing organizations and in the definition of financial participants. And they, too, can take advantage of the bankruptcy code safe harbors. So Congress, in its attempt to BAPCPA, Consumer Protection Act, is the CPA. In order to protect consumers, we're going to wrap in all these other entities so that they don't take losses if things go pear-shaped. and we'll call it, what do you think about the Consumer Protection Act? Absolutely. Let's get Elizabeth Warren on the line. I'm sure she'll love this, right? It's just like, it's so gross. Sausage making. So let's look at how this actually plays out in a court system, because then you'll understand why there's really only two paths for this whole thing. And one of them is more bailouts when they get in trouble. And the other is we go down this court system path. When you see one of these court things unravel a little bit, you'll be like, that would be painful. That would take forever. So this is a famous case right here. It involves Lehman Brothers Holdings. This is way after the fact. I think this is from 2014 or something. Or 18. Anyway, way after the fact. This thing failed a long time ago. And Lehman Brothers, there were some unsecured creditors who got the 546E shaft, and they're like, that didn't feel right. So they tried to get that money back, and it was a lot of money, right? And so this is the judge's ruling from Judge Polk here. And James Peck. Polk was the other guy for the other one. So the introduction to this thing said here, the adversary proceeding is brought jointly. So it's brought by Lehman Brothers. It's against JP Morgan. And the plaintiffs here seek to recover $8.6 billion from JP Morgan Chase for the benefit of Lehman's creditors. So that's a lot of money, $8.6 billion. What happened? The litigation relates to transactions that occurred shortly before Lehman's bankruptcy filing and highlights various defensive actions taken by JP Morgan as part of the bank's efforts to limit the impact on JP Morgan of a default by Lehman. Of course, the litigation touches on and illuminates the safe harbor provisions of this code. Okay. And what was interesting was in the introduction, this judge wrote, having considered the arguments of the parties, the court grants the motion to the extent that it relates to those counts that seeks relief that is unavailable under terms of the applicable safe harbor actions of the bankruptcy code. No relief may be granted with respect to these counts, and they are dismissed. Like, because Lehman said, hey, look, they took a lot of our money right before we collapsed, and we kind of want that money back. And the judge said, well, I can't, because the safe harbor protections of the bankruptcy code say that they could do that. And there's nothing that the trustee can do, and there's nothing you can do, because they're a protected entity. In short, as a result of a count-by-count analysis, the court has concluded that the safe harbors are applicable to all claims based on preference liability or constructively fraudulent transfers. So, like, listen, they preferentially took money out to treat, you know, to save one class of creditors, but they had shafted these other creditors. You can't use that argument anymore. Look, they were constructively fraudulent. They coerced us into having to do these trades in a very awkward time, and that led to our collapse. That's constructive fraud. That doesn't count. Wow. It's interesting to watch sharks feeding on each other, which is exactly what happened here. And the judge couldn't even avoid saying that this thing definitely looked a little dodgy, but said it in legal speak. He said, this is a case that examines the conduct of a giant lender at a time when the financial markets were in turmoil. JP Morgan grabbed assets for itself at a critical time in its banking relationship with Lehman. Dodgy. The timing alone, weeks before bankruptcy, is enough reason to question the circumstances of what occurred. Like, that, you know, that looks dodgy. And you're absolutely right. Totally looks dodgy. The issues presented are especially difficult ones that one day may help define what constitutes acceptable conduct by a major financial institution during times of crisis. You think? Like, you know, it's just, this is crazy stuff to me anyway. You know, it was a crisis. The judge continues writing, the multiple causes of action in the amended complaint are based on allegations that J.P. Morgan took unfair advantage of Lehman at a time when Lehman depended on J.P. Morgan as its main source of pre-petition credit to sustain critical trading operations for customers. Decode that. It means J.P. Morgan withdrew funding at a time which would cause Lehman actually to fall. So was this actually a takedown? Was this a hit? Or was this a legit crisis? Well, on Wall Street, who even knows the difference, huh? Right? The claims all arise out of a series of actions taken by J.P. Morgan to mitigate the risks associated with advancing substantial liquidity each day to Lehman, measured in the tens of billions during the months leading up to the bankruptcy. These actions included a take-it-or-leave-it sorts of demands to a submissive Lehman that additional entities within the Lehman enterprise agree to be liable to J.P. Morgan, and that Lehman turn over multiple billions of dollars in incremental cash and liens and additional collateral, all as conditions to preserving the essential lending relationship. This all happened urgently at a time of growing concerns and heightened anxiety as to Lehman's deteriorating financial condition and the viability as an enterprise. Events proved that these concerns were justified. Of course they were, but was it the chicken or the egg? What caused what? And you can feel the language is starting to point out here. The judge is saying, oh yeah, you know, financial stability is at risk. You got to do these sorts of things. Now, here's where it gets really fascinating, where there J.P. Morgan argued in defending itself as the defendant, you know what, we're protected under Section 546E. The safe harbor provision. So now we're going to look at the case precedent. If you ever wanted to see something in black and white, it's this right here. J.P. Morgan Chase, as one of the leading financial institutions in the world, quite obviously is a member of the protected class and qualifies as both a financial institution and a financial participant. So double coverage, right? Okay. So, it's very clear that what's happened in all of these cases, they said, look, the safe harbor provision, it's law. It's written in. It has a protected class of institutions and participants, right? If you don't have a billion under management or you're not a big bank or you don't qualify or whatever, doesn't apply to you. And it applies to a whole set of contracts that exist out there that are qualified financial contracts that have senior claim that takes precedence over anything else going on in that company at the time. So this is actually a big deal. Now, here's the summary of this part, all about this. First, the automatic stay. An automatic stay, if you enter bankruptcy again, it's an injunction. It stops the collection of pre-bankruptcy debts. It protects the property of the estate. It's automatic. You don't even have to provide notice. It self-executes as soon as you file bankruptcy. Boom, creditors are locked out. Except, as Charles writes again, exceptions to the automatic stay, a debtor's counterparty may terminate a qualified financial contract and offset and net out the party's obligations, including enforcement against collateral, which might be your stocks and bonds, under one qualified financial contract or multiple QFCs, free of the restraints of the automatic stay. The automatic stay does not apply. Whoops. Moreover, it may terminate the transaction based on the debtor's bankruptcy petition, insolvency, or financial condition. So it's like it could even be triggered. Its lack of an automatic stay is like, I wrote it in the contract. You enter into bankruptcy and all our contracts, you know, accelerate. You have to give me all my money back right now. This is not how this is supposed to work. All your other creditors have to get in a line under bankruptcy. Here, there's a preferential line. Everybody else is in one line. All frozen out. That might be you and your bank and your brokerage account. You're frozen. You'll get a pro rata share of whatever's left over of the pooled collateral, which you call stocks and bonds in your portfolio, once they net everything out and all these other counterparties finish doing what they feel they want to do and are owed. And as well, there's no avoidance. The safe harbor also includes broad protections from avoidance, right? It could be preference or it could be constructive fraudulent transfer for transfer made in connection with QFCs. With transfers generally protected from avoidance, you can't stop it. So no automatic stay, and you can't stop it from happening. Okay? So that's how that goes. So here are my conclusions to this whole interesting part. First, the vast bulk of U.S. citizens have their financial assets held for them in what are called security entitlement form or format. And those claims, they're unsecured. and therefore in a very weak position should a bankruptcy of a broker, a clearinghouse, or other intermediary occur who can lay claim to those same collateral assets. The senior claims are actually held by those who have what are called qualified financial contracts, or QFCs. And under a very broad set of circumstances, the entities holding those QFCs may settle those outright for and even during a bankruptcy. And the bankruptcy trustees have a steep hill to climb. They routinely get shot down in court if they try and avoid those transfers or invoke constructive fraud. They just can't stop it. It happens anyway. And the purpose of all that legal wrangling, really, was supposedly to make the financial system more stable and secure. That was the intent. But that didn't happen. The actual effect was that now derivatives are best measured in quadrillions, and the big banks are even more bigger and more concentrated and larger and all of that. So it's kind of like Congress, I think, it's like watching maybe the city council in San Francisco, like, we know the solution for all this shoplifting felonies is to raise the shoplifting limit to $950. Genius, Mortimer. You know, it's just like, so the intention and the effect are totally separated from each other, and they can't see that they've just done something really horrendously wrong. Now, my verdict then of everything, of all of those words right there, is that everything that I've been reading about so far in The Great Taking is absolutely true. And so what happens with that? Well, now I'm going to go over to my subscribers at Peak Prosperity, and we're going to be discussing how this may all play out and another, I think, genius way to protect your assets and everything that you have. So if you want to come over to Peak Prosperity, please do. We have great conversations. We would love to see you there. And I invite you to come and join us. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll see you next time. Bye-bye.